This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
Welcome to the 29th annual Writers Symposium by the Sea, a bonus edition at Point Loma Nazarene University. I'm Dean Nelson. I'm the journalism faculty at the school. And tonight we have with us Anne Lamott, who will be talking about her new book, Somehow, Thoughts on Love. She's also known for her other books, Bird by Bird, Operating Instructions, Plan B, Traveling Mercies, Stitches, Hallelujah Anyway, and many others. We were going to do a regular traditional introduction with her, but she had some other ideas. You'll see what I mean.
Can we just skip the introduction? We've already lost a lot of time. We're losing more second by second. And I really think they know who I am, and we go back, it was 17 years ago, blah, blah, blah. And I just think we're gonna eat up a lot of time. We don't have all that much to begin with.
You know, I wrote a book about interviewing. And one of the tenets of that book is somebody's gonna own the interview and it always has to be the interviewer. And I just lost control.
You just lost it, yeah. I actually hate the introductions though, everywhere I go. I hate them, I just dread them. I just think we should just jump in, okay?
All right. We good? We're already rolling. So, this is the fourth time you've been with us. Welcome back.
Thank you, Dean.
We love having you here. Let's start with something from your new book, Somehow.
Okay.
All right? And I have a few lines bracketed for you.
Okay.
Right here.
Yep. I want to say hi to my cousins who are here tonight.
Jack and Betty are here, I assume.
Over there. And my really cherished and beloved vet, Laura Landman, is somewhere here too. And I want to just thank you all for coming. I love this place, so thank you. Okay. I'm going to go up a tiny bit higher.
Once again, I have lost control. I bracketed some lines for her to read, and she can't even do that.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. Curiosity leads to wonder, and wonder is a cousin to love. Wonder is why we are here. And the beams of love. They're everywhere, particles in everything, like when a packet of jam leaks in a spaceship and infinitesimal specks end up in every molecule. You're feeling doomed, say, on your own behalf or your child's or nephew's or Ukraine's or Malawi's. Then someone or something emerges, stage left, a parent, a friend, an election, a dog, a train ticket, a relative, and there is a new feeling in your heart. Your soul does not want to jinx this, but secretly it cannot help doing a double take with relief or quiet joy. There is still a dark place just out of sight, but also there's a sneaky, mystical, jagged slash of light, a reflection that says, this is the dark, but we have some light as well. You hadn't known that. It had not seemed possible, not in the natural world. To experience things not of this world is to experience soul. To know the soul is to know love. I'll tell you what Blake wrote more than 200 years ago. And we are put on earth a little space that we may learn to bear the beams of love. If the younger ones in our lives can remember only this one idea, that they are here briefly, a little space, to love and to have been loved, then they will have all they need, because love is all they need, rain or shine. Love, cough drops in one another. Good old love, elusive and steadfast, fragile and unbreakable, and always there for the asking, always, somehow.
So beautiful, thank you. We'll get to more about your book in just a minute, but don't you feel like you're kind of in the cultural center of things now that you've been quoted in Ted Lasso?
I do. I completely do.
You've arrived.
Yeah. I do, but you know, a few years ago I was watching Orange is the New Black, and there was this very intense, scary Russian cook, Red, right? And at one point, Red took her girls out, the team, and she read to them from Bird by Bird. But and I couldn't process it at first because I thought it sounded so familiar, you know. And then little by little, I realized it, and that was so cool. And then before I started watching Ted Lasso, people started saying, "Oh, he mentions Bird by Bird," and so then of course I couldn't get to it fast enough.
Well, that and being asked to be a columnist for the Washington Post.
Yeah.
You've arrived, Dan.
I know, right. But I have to say, the Washington Post about 8 months ago asked if I would start writing these columns on being older. And I was so insulted, you know, because I'm only 57, really. And your inside person doesn't age, you know, and you are lots of different ages. And so after I got over the feeling of being insulted, I thought I'd love to write about this because I love being older. It's so much easier for me. Isn't it easier for you?
I wouldn't know. I'm taking your word for it. I'm following your columns.
Yeah. What, I'm 2 months older or something than you?
Yes, you are.
Yeah. Okay.
So thank you for revealing what I thought was a secret, but that's okay. So we're going to talk about all that because we've saved so much time because of the introduction. And so here's, years ago, when I first started reading what you write, it seemed like you were one of the few people who would talk openly about grief and loss. And you gave such profound language to it, and you made it so personal, which of course made it so universal. But now, doesn't it seem like everybody's writing about grief these days? It's like its own genre now.
Yeah, grief is like the it girl, but it will pass. People will lose interest in it, but
you were one of the early ones.
My first book was about, it was about the loss of my father to brain cancer when I was 25, and the book came out when I was 26. I've been writing about it for a long time because I actually think that the reason people and countries and families are so troubled and scared and screwed up is because we were never allowed to do grief. You know, you were not supposed to cry. Or if you needed to cry because there had been a devastating loss, there was a grid. And if it was a spouse, you could grieve for a year. That was the system. If it was a brother or sister, you could have, I think, 4 months. And if it was a best friend, 3 months. And if it was a pet, a week and a half. But it was all laid out, right? And it turned out, little by little, people were discovering, and I was writing about the fact that it's grief is a lazy Susan, you know, and it spins until it starts to spin so slowly that it's very quietly in the background. But some days, grief, the lazy Susan lands on numb. And you might actually have a really great phase of numb. And then the lazy Susan spins again, and you're in like, almost hysterical and stunned that you could ever feel this much devastation and like a burn victim that you have no protective covering. And then the lazy Susan spins and you feel this depth of soul connection, umbilical connection to the person who passed and really to much more of life because you're not hiding from so much anymore. And so, I noticed grief is just having its day.
It is, yeah. which I think is wonderful. We're actually giving voice to it and permission.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things I appreciate about you is that you were doing this a long time ago.
Oh, thank you.
And
thank you.
Maybe have started some of this openness.
Well, when I was when my dad got sick, I was 23. It was 1977.
Okay.
And I did what you do when you have a crisis. If you're a writer and a reader, you go to the library or you go to Warwick's, you go to a bookstore, and you find books that are about what you're going through. And there was nothing on cancer and death because it was still considered unseemly. You weren't even supposed to say the word cancer because there was so much superstition. People might catch it. You know, and so in Hard Laughter, I wrote a lot about our family, like announcing it all the time so we could deal with it in a way that was more authentic and that wasn't so guarded and girded. But so my dad and our really close friend Susan, who had cancer at the same time, we would all sit outside the bakery in this tiny seaside town, and my dad would say, "Well, Susan, how is your cancer today?" But really loudly, you know. And then Susan would say, "Well, my cancer is progressing. How is yours, Ken?" And
did it just draw people around?
It's no,
like,
I mean,
oh, they love hearing
it. It just
stuff.
Made people so anxious, so I knew we were onto something. And so, but then I wrote, you know, I've always, with my writing students, said, write what you'd love to come upon. Because mm-hmm. if you write what you'd love to come upon, it exists. And I would have loved a book that was about how you can experience grace along with the pain and experience laughter along with the tears and the whole gestalt of the experience of life and death. You know, I've always said laughter is carbonated holiness. And when your family is in the dark pit about to lose somebody and someone makes you laugh, it literally is like God has reached down and touched you. So then many years later, 10 years later, I had a child. I was single and I didn't have any money. And so I went to the library and I went to the independent bookstore, and there were no books that were real enough. There were wonderful books by pediatricians, Dr. Spock, who all of our parents raised us on, and not Star Trek Dr. Spock, but famous pediatrician.
Not the Live Long and Prosper.
Right. And boy, there was nothing that on some days you just hate it all, and that you don't have a micro unit of energy left, and that you've realized you don't like children. And so I started writing a book that would say, you're going to be bored, you're going to be angry, you're going to need a lot more help. All the women I know had been raised being the helpers, being the flight attendants to the world, being the person who always pushed back their sleeves, and you need to ask people to step in, and it's so hard. And so I wrote that book, and then, this sounds all really self-aggrandizing, but then about a year later, I just started thinking about all the writing books that said, if you do this, if you do an outline, if you do that, if you do this, well, then surely you will meet with success and probably get to retire from doing anything else. And I was still cleaning houses, you know, teaching tennis. And so I wanted to write a book that said the publication and any slim chance of making a living is not going to work because it's going to wear off, but the writing won't. And if you set a habit and you write by prearrangement with yourself as a debt of honor because you have a gift and a thirst, you know, the Christian mystic said is the like getting anywhere isn't the gift. The gift is the thirst to know God, to have union, to be part of the kingdom.
Right.
It's the thirst for that. That's the gift. It's not thinking. I mean, and it's the same with writing. You do not arrive anywhere. This is my 20th book, and I had the exact same proportions of grandiosity and terrible self-esteem when I sat down to write it. But bird by bird, I said what it is really like. Do this. This will help you. Write terrible first drafts. Write really short assignments. You know, that one inch.
Hold it. I'm taking control here.
Okay.
Just for a moment. 20th book, and you're still writing terrible first drafts?
Definitely. Yeah, everything I write, those pieces that you like in the Washington Post, terrible first drafts, they can only be 1,100 words, which is about four pages, right? Mm-hmm. Four manuscript pages. Mm-hmm. And they start off at 1,900. And every word is so precious. And they want 1,000, but they've learned that I'm going to turn in 1,100. And and I have to go over it and over it and over it.
Sure.
And when I get it down to about 1,300, I give it to my husband, and he goes over it. And he's a brilliant editor, and he knows that if he suggests I take out this or that paragraph, that it's just going to be a terrible evening, right? Mm-hmm. And so he will very gently take out words and phrases. My problems are the same as your problems for all of you who are writing. I write too long. The descriptions are too long, right? There's too many adverbs. There's too many adjectives. Those 1,100-word pieces take a full week.
Well, there's so much wisdom in those columns and in this new book somehow, where I just feel like you've become a really, really wise woman. And I'm wondering, yeah, you have. Or maybe you always were, maybe that's why you're shaking your head. But you, there is wisdom in here. And so I'm just wondering, do you think about at age 70, what you wish you would have thought about or done at age 50 or at age 30 or anything like that? Do you ever think that way?
Well, I want to point out that I've only been 70 for like 5 days. So I think of myself as still being in my 60s, my very late 60s. But, I got sober almost 38 years ago in 1986. And at that point, I started learning some truth about who I really was. I wasn't a bad person wanting to get good. I was just a sick person with addiction trying to get well. And I had always, like a lot of women, I'm, and this may be true for men, but I don't know it so intimately. I had always compared my insides to other people's outsides. And everybody looked, we curate our lives. We look a certain way. It's like curating your Facebook pages, which I don't really do. But you start to realize that no matter how wonderful people are looking, that we're all in the same boat. That it's really scary to be here on Earth. It's especially scary in the last 10 years. In fact, that's why I wrote Somehow. It was because I started to feel so sad and scared for my son and grandson and the future that they're going to be facing after I'm gone. And so I wanted to write in one place everything I was pretty sure of that has always worked before. Community, the woods, poetry, radical self-love, friendliness with yourself, spiritual communities, paths with a little light to see by on them, meditation.
You're articulating all of that in this book. So those were things that sort of emerged over time?
Well, I'll tell you, I wanted to write a book for my son and grandson, and I was going to call it P.S. And it was everything I had meant to get around to writing about. I wanted to write more about community, because it's like the great Frederick Buechner said, you can thrive without community. You can get really, really, really far ahead without community. You look fabulous without community, but you can't become human without community. I'd say Frederick Buechner is my favorite living theologian, but it's Buechner, but it's pronounced Buechner. But he'll change your life. It's Buech. And anyway, so I was going to write this book called P.S., and then, so I started writing these pieces about how you come to self-love, especially when you've just failed, maybe publicly, or in front of people that matter so deeply to you, or how you come out of the deepest kind of holes or whatever. And it turned out every piece I was writing had somehow or other to do with love. So I thought, oh, I think I'm writing a book about love, which, having been born and raised and never left California, was too California for me. But
I think that's actually beautiful. And it's also how kind of the creative impulse works, is you think you're doing this.
Right.
And it tells you, no, it's right. Actually about this.
Yeah.
So you're able to listen to that voice,
yeah,
and not control it, but let it emerge.
Well, I wrote in Bird by Bird that, and I believe this, that the material knows what it is. Mm-hmm. And the material's in us. It's flowed into us, and it, you know, it noodles around, and it breathes when you breathe, but it doesn't have hands. And it needs us to get it down on paper, and we need to get out of the way. I say this funny little prayer a lot of mornings. I say, help me get out of my way so I can write what wants to be written.
That's good.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's really good. And the other thing that came out of this book and has come out in your Washington Post columns is this tendency that maybe you used to have, which is you used to get worked up about a lot more things,
yeah,
and you don't get worked up about as many things.
Not
these
nearly
days.
As many. Like, I used to care a lot more what my butt looked like. You know, I really, it drove me. And then you hit 60 or something. I think that's when the really deep healing begins. And, I mean, it could start whenever you decide it starts. It could have, I wish it, it started for me pretty much when I got sober, where I was caring so much more about soul and spirit and being of service to other people. But, boy, by 60, you've lost some people's, you've had some unsurvivable losses of people younger than you, and you realize we're all on borrowed time, and you start to get serious about what you're going to invest your life force into. And it just can't be your thighs, you know? It just can't be your thighs. Please. Let me tell you one story. I wrote about this somewhere, I think Bird by Bird, but when my best friend of many years, decades, Pammy died, right before she died, she was in a wig and a wheelchair, and I was trying on a dress because I had a date with the current hostage who liked women he wanted me to dress up for this Lucinda Williams concert. And so, and I usually dress like John Goodman. I really do. I really do, and I don't really care. But I got this sort of tight, sort of short little dress, and I came out to model it for Pammy. And I said to her, do you think this makes me look big in the thighs? And she just looked at me, and she said, Annie, you don't have that kind of time. You know, and it just broke the trance for me. And that, I was about, I think it was 37 when she was 37 when she died, and I was 37 too. And I got it, that you don't, that you have a certain amount of time every day. And how are you going to spend it? You know, or as Mary Oliver says, how are you going to spend this one precious life?
Which I think is really one of the subtexts of this entire book, is how I'm at this age now, and I can speak to an audience with maybe a little more wisdom and say, yeah, this borrowed time concept, and we gotta decide what we're going to take seriously these days.
Yeah.
And what we're not going to
right.
try to control
right.
the outcomes. One of the themes I really do want to ask you, though, from this, is that you seem to be saying in many of the essays in here that things are going to work out.
Yeah.
And yet, I'm thinking in your younger life, when you were struggling with addiction, you're trying to raise a son, you're trying to survive, and things were really dire for you, being told that things were going to work out, I don't know that that would have been helpful at
yeah.
that time, would it?
I don't know. Everything changed for me when I got sober, is all I can say, and that people said all I had to do was not pick up a drink or drug that day. And they said, I heard this in 1986, Figure it out is not a good slogan. But I was raised by intellectuals and atheists, and I was raised to figure it out. And when I started hearing that figure it out was not a good slogan, after all, and that all I had to do was to not drink or take a drug for that day, then I could claim victory, I started to feel like if they said if I keep doing this, I'll be okay. But I also, you know, I said in the book something my husband says and believes and has pretty much convinced me of. He says, life tilts towards the good. And there was this man who helped AA get off the ground, a priest in 1935, who said to Bill, sometimes I think that heaven is just a new pair of glasses. And so when I have this one pair of glasses on, I just can see how annoying people are and how doomed we all are politically and how hopeless it all is and how, you know, whatever. And then if I put on metaphorically and physically the new pair of glasses, I just see how much beauty, how much what we would call grace, the movement of grace, and the beauty of the world and of people's hearts, instead of how annoying they are, how annoying I am. And so, you know, it's funny because I was in New York and Boston and Washington last week, and I was on California time and getting up, you know, at 2 and 3, and I'm just too old. I really am. It was easier at 50, but I can't really lift my own carry-on anymore. So I go into this sort of Blanche DuBois mode, and I go, excuse me, young man. But anyway, when I got home, it was really hard. I only had 36 hours at home, and I was just dead beat, and I was just all used up. And all sorts of things were going on that were just annoying me and that were hard. And then I felt kind of sad and bitter that I had to leave again, and we have a 10-month-old kitten, and it makes it harder and whatnot. But I have two pairs of glasses. I have these ones, which my son says are more glamorous, but I was wearing the wire rims in on the East Coast because he said they make me look more educated, which I'm not. And so, but I had, and they're great looking. But this morning I thought, Annie, put on the good pair of glasses. So I just went and fished these out and put them on to change myself cellularly and to see things that work and that are just fine, and if not even lovely and sweet. Like, we had such a fun time backstage with the Warwick's people and the Point Loma Nazarene people, and we just had fun, and we were laughing a lot, and we prayed, and we just had a lot of connection. And I think that's why we're here. And I think that's what people are just grief-struck and sad about, is that the world has just, everything's so isolated, and we're so isolated, and, you know, especially since COVID. And so, you know, you find it, at the very beginning of the book, I'll read a couple sentences from the beginning. It says.
You say.
It says.
Your editor rewrote and said.
Yes. Even in the darkest and most devastating times, love is nearby if you know what to look for. It does not always appear at first to be lovely, but instead may take the form of a hot mess or a snoring old dog or someone you have sworn to never, ever forgive for a possibly very good reason, if you ask me. But mixed in will also be the familiar signs of love. Wings, good-natured people, cats, when they're in the right mood, a spray of wildflowers, a cup of tea. What are we even talking about when we talk about love? What is it? I asked a 7-year-old friend of mine. Oh, it's just this stuff, he said, rolling his eyes. I think that's right. Love is caring, affection, and friendliness, of course, compassion, and a generous heart. It is also some kind of energy or vibration, because everything is the same stuff moving at different speeds from glaciers to 7-year-old boys. But we would both say that one energy that Einstein said there's one thing, everything's made of it, whether it's the stars or whether it's your grandchild, or whether it's some berries, there's just this one thing. And we would say as believers that it's just this love energy, right? Mm-hmm. That's all there is, in different shapes and speeds. And so I forgot why I started in on that.
Well,
maybe you could take control about now.
Well, I was going to say, how's this working out for you? You can't even follow your own train of thought. Well, actually, I do want to address kind of where you just were, because one of my favorite lines from this book is, even in the darkest and most devastating times, love is nearby if you know what to look for. Love is our only hope. So my question is, how do you look for it? How do you find it?
Well, I think partly you decide to, because you've decided that if you spend time with old people or people who are probably going to be facing death really soon, they're not talking about their achievements. They're not talking about the degrees they got and the multiple degrees and about their promotions. They're talking about the love that they have felt blessed by and tended to even as they're closing up shop. And so you start looking for people who have been able to take off a lot of the false self. You know, so my friend Duncan Trussell, who is Mike the comedian, said when you first meet him, you're meeting his bodyguard. And as you get older and you're losing more and more people, you just start taking off your armor and the false selves, and you start becoming more and more who you were actually born to be. You know, the movement of love you discover in yourself when your heart turns out to be feeling more generous than you would have given yourself credit for, or when you're starting to forgive somebody that you've just not felt like being around for a long time, and you suddenly realize who they are, that they're just another suffering human being, that they're going through battles you can't even guess at. And you just get that first feeling of warmth for them. That's the movement of love, and we would say the movement of God in our lives. But so I think it's that you decide to. My husband said, and I used this at the very beginning of the book, that everything that is true and beautiful can be discovered again and again on any 10-minute walk. So instead of sitting there brooding or making lists of who's to blame and how they should correct their behavior, you take a 10-minute walk and you see Jesse, who's 93, and goes for a walk every day because people come by to be with him so he can stay safe. And you see the new little kid down the street who is taking his first very drunken steps, and the neighbors have come out to watch and cheer. That's a movement of love. It's partly a decision, I think, and it's also, you know what, Susan B. Anthony's grandniece, whose name coincidentally is also Susan B. Anthony, is a sober therapist, and she said in these very, very dark times, we remember to remember. And so we remember how many times we thought the jig was up, and love stepped in. Love as a neighbor, as a minister, as a rabbi, as a child, as a baby, as a dog. And we remember to remember awful, awful, awful times in our families' lives, in our political realms, in the world's environmental disaster. And we look for things that are going better now, that people are plugged in, that something's happening. You don't go anywhere now. You don't go anywhere without seeing recycling bins, right?
That's an improvement, isn't it?
And that's an improvement. And in recovery, they say progress, not perfection. Partly for me, it was about doing the deep dive into this lifelong perfectionism that just nearly killed me. Mm-hmm. I wrote a lot about it in Bird by Bird, but I've talked about it since, that if you don't know where to start this journey of a new life, start with getting some help for the perfectionism. It's the most wonderful thing of all to start making more mistakes and finding them funny. If you're writing, they're great material. Nothing better.
So here's another line that I just love, but I don't know why.
Okay.
And that is, you've got this line that says, love is actually scary about half the time.
Mm-hmm.
What's so scary about it?
Well, first of all, because you could lose it. you know.
What do you mean?
Well, I mean, someone could leave you, or somebody who is young or precious could die.
Oh,
we've
okay.
All of our friends have lost. My very best friend lost her 23-year-old son to cancer last year. I mean, there should be one rule. If I were God's West Coast representative, there would be one rule that you can't hurt children and they don't get cancer, and that we would all globally agree on that. But
in fact, I think you said life is such a mystery that you have to wonder if God drinks a little.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, some days a lot, and it, you get, when you get old, people, you go to a lot of memorial services, and then you talk about with the survivors about how many memorial services you've been to lately.
Oh, okay. Okay. So that's what you mean by scary, because it costs.
No, that's one realm. The other realm is that there's an acronym, in, or it's not an acronym exactly, but a thing in recovery that uses the word intimacy as into me I see. And the one thing we've been running from our entire lives is who we actually are, beyond our accomplishments and our fabulous personas and personalities and achievements and connections and whatnot. And one of my favorite writers in my entire life was Gabriel Garcia Marquez, 100 Years of Solitude. And I mean, everything he writes is on beyond zebra, but he said we have our public life, our private life, and our secret life. And the secret life is so scary, but trying to pretend it's not there, or trying to, you know, trick it out with a cute new throw rug from IKEA is why we have these psychic and mental struggles, why there is so much destruction, why there are all these shootings, is because we can't accept deep down there are shadows. But what you learn when you do the intimacy with people is, A, we're all the same person. We are all the same person. If you stop comparing your insides to other people's outsides, and it's a miracle to be able to bring forth that stuff that is so scary about who we are. You know, I can be very judgmental, just instant ticker tape of judgment, good bad, he's good, he's bad, he's good, he's bad, he's a, this is good, she's good, I like her, no, I don't know, boy, she makes me, you know, instant. I can be so petty. I can shut down like a bank vault.
Even now that
yeah, like
five
today,
days into your 70s?
Yeah, today, well, in my very late 60s. But today, the Golden Gate Bridge was closed because of protesters, and I was trying to get to the airport, right? So we had to take the back road to Oakland through Berkeley, and it was really long, and it was what it was, and I got there in plenty of time, but it was stressful, and I'm very, very, very tired. And so we got to the airport, and I got here, and I was really looking forward mostly just to seeing you and my cousins and my vet, Laura Landman. And so, and I love being here at the university, and I always have. But so I got here, it was 3:30, and my room wasn't ready. And I was too tired for it not to be ready. And the publisher hadn't put their credit card down. So I had a $500 bill on my credit card, and there was no room. And I just started crying. Mm. I sat in the lobby, and I had this horrible salad from SFO that I probably have ptomaine poisoning or something. And I sat in the lobby eating this terrible salad and crying. And then I turned on the publicist. And I have not been at warmed with her. And she asks, is everything okay? And I did this very wise, mature thing, which was not replying. You know what? I could have just said, everything's fine.
Really?
Maybe I'll do that right now.
Could we shut off the Wi-Fi just for a moment?
What?
Are you...
Okay, hold on. I made a typo.
The cameras are rolling, you know. Just
okay.
Give her my
greeting. So see, I know we're at a Christian university, so I don't want to say what my father was an atheist, but he had two rules. I have two brothers, older and younger. One rule was that you remember people's names. And no matter what station in life, where they are, you remember people's names to honor everyone equally, right? And the second rule was don't be an asshat or a glass bowl. And it was this very strict rule, don't be a jerk. Don't be a brat. And I've been being a brat for like 3 hours because I was too tired and I couldn't.
But didn't it feel good though?
No, it feels
really?
Terrible.
Really?
You know what? Being sober and being I've been sober almost 38 years, and I've been a Christian 39, so I had that kind of gap year.
Mm-hmm.
But and I was going to church.
That's how it works.
I was going to church very hungover and very smelly and very arrogant, which is a lovely combination of things. But around the time I got sober, the woman that helped me, it kind of wrecked that feeling of victimized self-righteousness, which is what I got stuck in today when there was no room for half an hour, you know, and I lost, I had 2 hours I was supposed to have before I got picked up, and only I had less than an hour and a half, and I was frustrated. You would say to me, you know what, no kidding, you're exhausted and you lost a half an hour, but I don't, without
that isn't what I was thinking, but...
Oh, okay.
But
you were thought,
ahead.
Oh my God, why did we invite her here?
that is what I was thinking.
That is what, I know that. But see, the way I would talk to you if you said the same thing, I'd say, God, how could you not feel frustrated and sad and teary because you're exhausted and you were counting on a chunk of time. But with me, I would think, first of all, I'd think, okay, that is it. No more books. I am not touring again. I have been inconvenienced. And then I also thought, God, you're such a disaster, Annie. You know, this is not Ukraine. You know, I'm in a nice hotel in San Diego with my terrible salad. And you could conceivably, if you weren't so crazy right this minute, order a fresh one, you know? So, I mean, the miracle for me, and this is a lot of the book, is how do we learn to speak to ourselves the way we speak to even strangers, anyone here, you could tell me that, and I would say, oh, I really understand. You were looking forward to some downtime, and you were hungry probably in your time. But with me, I either go into victimized self-righteousness, or I think I just have a bad character. And so little by little by little, that is being healed in me as the perfectionism dwindles. I have to say, the spiritual healing that you like to talk about, your ilk like to talk about, is going, your ilky ilk is going a little bit more slowly than I had hoped.
Which is why we need your book, right? Yeah, so thank you for that help, that unsolicited help that you just gave.
Yeah, as we say, that help is the sunny side of control. But there's a piece in the book, and I think it's one of the most important pieces, and the toughest, is when a very cherished friend turns on me. And
that was so hard to read.
And says she doesn't want to be like me.
Yeah.
Or he says he doesn't want to be like me and therefore can't be with me anymore.
Right.
And so the question for the piece is, I think a lot of us secretly worried about that our whole lives. Intimacy, if you see into me, I see that if people get to know you too intimately, they're going to run screaming for their cute little lives. The opposite is true. But what do you do if somebody who you love deeply, who you have felt loved by for decades, says they just don't want to turn out like you because you're disgusting?
Well, and this was a person who asked you to be his mentor.
Yeah, yeah.
He saw something in you then.
Yeah.
I want to be like that. And then you screwed it up.
Yep. Right. I know I did. I made a big mistake as part of it. And in my family, because we were perfectionists, you really didn't make mistakes. You didn't change your mind. You made decisions. You stuck with them. And in this one case, I just really blew it. And there was no forgiveness. And there was no, can we just talk about this? It was the guillotine blade dropped. I don't want to turn out like you. And the under mutter was, because you're repellent. You have a bad character. You've done something. So the piece is about, and I won't spoil you, how do you get out of a hole that deep? Right now, what I do is I say that to God. I just say those exact words. I say, I am in a hole too deep to fish my way out of.
So when you say that to God, what does God do?
God says, thank you. I was wondering how much longer it was going to take. I'm right here. I don't go anywhere when you can't feel me. I'm right here. Put it down. Just put it down at your feet. You know, lay down your sorrows. We put it at the mercy seat. And we say to God, maybe I'm not going to end up with this friend. I don't know how it's going to shake down. But all I want is union with you again. And I want to be able to be friendly to myself again. So have a go at it. And 100% of the time, when I put down my weapons, which are being right and being so tragically talked to and whatnot, I put down my weapons, I come over to the winning side, which is surrendering to God, you know, all over and over and over again. And I have one tool, which is I write down things. Like I might write down that person's name, Tim. And in grief, maybe still crying, I fold it up and I put it in a God box. I say to God, I'm going to keep my sticky fingers off the controls of this spaceship until I hear from you. And then I do. And then I also pick up the 200-pound phone and I call someone or I go find my husband or my son and I say, I'm not okay. Do you have a minute? But I didn't know how to do that till I got sober.
You know, it's interesting that you bring this up because when you talk about just laying it down and coming to the mercy seat and all this stuff, to a certain kind of an audience, that would sound like just such a bunch of platitudes.
Yeah.
But I know you're coming at this from experience.
Yeah.
And you've come out of these terrible, terrible times of darkness, and I know you really believe that.
I really do believe it, but also the willingness 100% of the time for me to change or surrender or to seek help comes from the pain. And I have to make myself a certain level of crazy before I will seek help from God or from a friend at the other end of the line. And so what I have is a lot of experience of trying to get things to fit. Like, you know what? There's an old Peanuts cartoon from 60 years ago. You are probably still in diapers.
No.
But
I did have incontinence problems at age 10, so how did you know?
But Lucy says to Charlie Brown, how many times does 3 go into 7? And Charlie Brown says, well, 3 doesn't go into 7. And Lucy says, it does if you force it, right? And so when I am trying to force something to turn out the way I'm positive, it should turn out for everyone to feel happier and for for goodness to be reestablished, I have to make myself crazy. And stop. I have to just stop and breathe. Left foot, right foot, left foot, breathe, and then get the help I need.
Wouldn't you think, though, that you've been doing this now for a long time? And it's the same question I had about, are you still writing terrible first drafts? Why can't we get past all this?
I don't know. Are you a minister or something? Are you? I don't actually know what you are. I think you're Dean Nelson. You're
yeah.
the Dean of
I was
life.
Waiting for that. Yeah,
but
thank you.
I forgot. Are you a minister or anything?
No.
Oh, you're like a...
Why would you ask me that?
Well, because I thought you were the dean of Point Loma and that you must be have a lot of religious training. Do you have a doctorate in divinity or anything?
No.
You don't?
No.
Oh, my God.
I
all this time, I mean... Like, you could be a used car salesman. But anyway, I've always thought you were like a minister or something. But so the answer is, why does it keep... Because we're still alive. And life is messy. And sometimes it's hard. And we don't know how things are going to turn out for our young ones. And we don't think... We understand by a certain age that we're powerless over almost everything. And we feel as vulnerable as kittens. It's a violent world. Cain is still killing Abel. We see it every day if you're reading the paper or watching the news. And that is why it keeps coming up. Hmm. We kind of get it sorted. We get the blessing. We get the resurrection. We live in that for a while. And then, you know, life happens again. And you get the phone call or the text, and it's something really sad or scary, and you can't save the person, and you can't, and you just have to feel terrible with them, and you have to, you question everything you knew. Like I asked you before we came on, how has your sense of faith changed in the last, this is back when I thought you were a minister, but, and that you had multiple degrees in, like, theology, but.
Wait a second, I do have multiple degrees, but not in divinity.
Theology?
No.
Okay.
No.
I rest my case. Okay. So I asked you, how has your faith changed in the last 2 years? And what did you say?
I said, whatever I thought it was 2 years ago or 5 years ago or 20 years ago, that whatever my concept of God was then, it's more now. It's
right.
Never less.
It's bigger.
It's bigger.
Mm-hmm. Well, see,
does that help you
yes,
in some
but
way?
I don't think we get bigger and our lives become more expansive because we fall more and more for bumper stick theology,
correct.
Right?
Correct.
We grow and we grow in gratitude by being called to serve, by not running when people are suffering and troubled, whether it's in Malawi and we can have garage sales and we can send off money, we can show up for people when other people are too afraid to see them because they're too sick, and we just keep showing up, and it grows us. And when it grows us, it grows our understanding of God and of the mystery and the miracle of it all. And so I would say the same thing. And now, you know what? Life just gets so lifey sometimes. And if we are able, we rise to that new challenge that somebody's going through, or that we're going through, or that our child, our grown children are going through, and we sit with them and we breathe with them. I bet you give people a lot less advice than you used to. I do, because I realize how much, at this age, how little I know. And so what I do is I listen better, and if they ask for advice, I give it. If they don't, I don't.
In fact, I think one of my favorite essays in this book is called Hinges, and in there, you are really comfortable with the term, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And just saying, and I think that's one of the characteristics of wisdom, by the way, is you're comfortable now saying, yeah, I just don't know. And
well, Neil says, Neil does this work. It's very profound on the inner critic. He wrote a book called Better Days. And in it, he teaches you that there's been this voice on your shoulder your entire life telling you that you could do better, a little bit better, and you shouldn't shoot for so much because you might screw it up. You're good at the level you're at. Don't get outside the box. And it's called the inner critic. And so I met Neil about 8 years ago, and he started teaching me that I could isolate this voice and say to it, oh, it's you. And why don't you go to the library for a while because I've got some work to do. And since I learned to do that work with the inner critic, there's something in his book where he says, I don't know is the portal. That to think you know, it shuts you off from all those flecks of gold in the mind, because it's a detour away from what might be really juicy and illuminating stuff you can pass on as medicine. And so I started saying, we were supposed to know, you know? I thought you're supposed to know almost all this stuff or find out it. And he taught me that to say, I don't know, I don't have a clue, is the portal to the doors, to the hinges opening, to something that you couldn't have known was there, that makes you stop and go, wow.
Yeah, certainty is kind of overrated.
Definitely, yeah.
And that probably is something I've only come to in recent years. That's the kind of the wisdom of aging, maybe a little bit as well, is to realize you used to know everything.
I know.
Or have an answer.
You know more at 23 than you'll ever know again. It's all downhill from there. But that's the great gift of aging, is to know how little you know and to just go, oh, that's fine. Either I can find out, they can find out, or we don't need to know. But, you know, let me just tell you, when my mom was really sick with Alzheimer's, she also had diabetes and needed to eat a certain way, but she couldn't remember to. And it was scary, and she just had all the symptoms that you get with Alzheimer's. And we had a geriatric nurse come to see my brothers and I, and we were just like so frantic with anxiety. We were going, we don't know how to keep her from eating bread and cookies, and we don't know if she's getting her insulin, if she's on the right amount, and we don't know how much longer she can live independently, and we don't know what's next. And the woman, because she was older than we were, she just listened. The greatest gift we can give anyone, she just listened for a while. And then she said, how could you know? And it hadn't crossed my mind. What had crossed my mind was that we were failing somehow because we were floundering. And so I've said that to so many people since. I've said, how could you know?
Right. You know, you've given us great advice over the years that you've come to Point Loma and hung out with us. You've given us great writing advice, but now it's kind of all in a website on Sam's website,
yeah.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
Where Sam, can we find it, and what's on it?
Sam has a website with his fiance and his best friend and this business guy called awritingroom.com. It's not the writing room, it's a writing room. Is anyone here belong to it? Because, a few of you. And
people,
everywhere,
sure.
I go, people come up to me and they love it. It's a community right now of about 550 writers, some rank beginners, some published writers, and they do what you need to do. They have formed a community. If there are offshoots, there might be five people who are in your writing group and that are finishing seven pages every 10 days that they're getting to you to critique, and you're getting your seven pages of them, and you have to finish your stuff, which is the hard, it's another Neil thing from Better Days, is finish it. And they're bringing in, I teach there a lot. I did a bird by bird writing group there over 5 weeks, and I divided the book into fifths and talked people through it. I did a thing on getting unstuck. I think it was called Unstuck 101. But just check it out, because I think there's a bunch of free lectures there. Editors come on and tell you what they're really looking for. Agents come on. Editors tell you how to edit. And there's just tons of classes and stuff. And so he's got, before that he had a website called HelloHumans.co, because the .com was taken. And it was really fancy, famous people talking about how to become fully human. And you can go to that. That's free. You have to pay something for a writingroom.com. But if you go to Hello Humans, you can get Jack Kornfield and Byron Katie and Frank Rich and so many well-known spiritual teachers talking about how to become fully human, how to wake up to what is, well, the Greeks called God really real, to wake up to the really real. So that's those are his two websites. He's 35. People think, oh my gosh, you must be in college now, because they all met him when I wrote operating instructions. But he's 34 and he has a 15-year-old son.
Well, this book somehow will help us become fully human as well.
I hope.
It really will. So finish us off here with, there's a poem that is significant to you. You wanna close us out that way?
I do. I thought we were
having... You weren't gonna start doing emails or anything.
Yeah, here, just a real quick one. No. So this is a poem, and it might cause you to wonder, because it's written. I read it Saturday night in a huge auditorium, because it's my favorite poem about grace and love and goodness and putting on the good pair of glasses and not giving up, because there's so much dark and evil and death and violence around us. But it's written by my favorite poet, who is an Arab American, and I know a lot of you know her work. It's called, her name is Naomi Shihab Nye, right? And she writes these books that you foist on other people and you give them as presents because they're beautiful. But there was this weird pushback from the organizer of the event, who said, "I can't believe you read a poem by an Arab American," and it was so strange. And so I'm just going to trust that you understand that my prayer is for peace. My prayer is for peace and goodness all around the world. And this isn't a thing, okay? But I want you to know this poem, and when you get home, you can Google it. You know, when I was coming, well, the women's movement comes out when I'm 16 years old. I mean, the first issue of Ms. Magazine comes out. And at that point, we're still mimeographing poems by people that are changing our lives, by Merton. You know, in the famous Merton prayer. Just Google the Merton prayer. It'll change your life. As God is my witness, the Merton prayer. But anyway, remember the rollers and the purple ink and that stench of alcohol and turpentine? But that she's the sort of poet that you would roll off multiple and shove them. You got to read this. You got to read this. Well, I think this is one of those poems, and it's called Gate A4. Wandering around the Albuquerque airport terminal, after learning my flight had been delayed 4 hours, I heard an announcement. If anyone in the vicinity of Gate A4 understands any Arabic, please come to the gate immediately. Well, one pauses these days. Gate A4 was my own gate, though, so I went there. An older woman in full traditional Palestinian embroidered dress, just like my grandma wore, was crumpled to the floor, wailing. "Help," said the flight agent. "Talk to her. What is her problem? We told her the flight was going to be late, and she did this." I stooped to put my arm around the woman and spoke haltingly. "Shadow, Shabudia Kabidi, Stani Shwe, Minfadlik Shubitsiwi." The minute she heard my words, she knew, however poorly used. She stopped crying. She thought the flight had been canceled entirely. She needed to be in El Paso for major medical treatment the next day. I said, "No, we're fine. You'll get there just later. Who's picking you up? Let's call him." We called her son. I spoke with him in English. I told him I would stay with his mother till we got on the plane and ride next to her. She talked to him. Then we called her other sons just for the fun of it. Then we called my dad, and he and she spoke for a while in Arabic and found out, of course, they had 10 shared friends. Then I thought, just for the heck of it, why not call some Palestinian poets I know and let them chat with her? This all took 2 hours. She was laughing a lot by then, telling of her life, patting my knee, answering questions. She had pulled a sack of homemade mamoul cookies, little powdered sugar crumbly mounds stuffed with dates and nuts, from her bag and was offering them to all the women at the gate. To my amazement, not a single woman declined one. It was like a sacrament. The traveler from Argentina, the mom from California, the lovely woman from Laredo, we were all covered with the same powdered sugar and smiling. There is no better cookie. And then the airline broke out free apple juice from huge coolers, and two little girls from our flight ran around serving it all, and they were covered with powdered sugar too. And I noticed my new best friend, by now we were holding hands, had a potted plant poking out of her bag, some medicinal thing with green furry leaves. Such an old country tradition. Always carry a plant. Always stay rooted to somewhere. And I looked around that gate of late and weary ones, and I thought, this is the world I want to live in. The shared world. Not a single person in that gate, once the crying of confusion stopped, seemed apprehensive about any other person. They took the cookies. I wanted to hug all those other women, too. This can still happen anywhere. Not everything is lost. Amen, and thank you, and thank you, and thank you, Dean. No, what?
Sit down. So, hold on. It was recently your 70th birthday. We would like to acknowledge that. So, however we're going to do that is going to come out, and then we're going to sing. We're going to sing our way out. So, Julie or someone, are you nearby? Here we go. Here we go. Coming down the aisle here, and this is for you, and let's sing. Happy birthday to you.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Anne. Happy birthday to you.
Thank you.
A present too.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.